I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listen to it.
Howard,
that's the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Mr. Ward, I'm in big trouble. They came to pick me up and they started beating me up. I'm scared. I don't know. I don't know what to do.
This is Mary Kajumba. She's a 32-year-old college graduate from Kampala, Uganda.
I'm not going back there. I will not work with these people anymore.
But now she's in Iraq, whispering into her phone, terrified.
They are not good people. They are bad people. I'm tired. I just can't. I don't know what to do.
It's November 2022. Mary is working as a cleaner in an upscale neighborhood in Baghdad. She left her 5-year-old daughter with a friend in Uganda to take the job. Mary was told she would earn 4 times what she could make in Uganda. She's been in Iraq for 6 months. I'm Jasmine Jiwa, a freelance journalist based in New York City. For the past 2 years, I've been following the stories of women like Mary who live under forced labor conditions. In the Persian Gulf and Middle East, women from sub-Saharan Africa are trafficked, transported, threatened, and forced to work as cleaners or domestic servants for little to no wages. In this episode of Storylines, I'm going to follow the story of Mary, a mother from Uganda who was tricked into going to Iraq, and an anti-trafficking activist in Canada trying to get her home.
I don't know, if I run away, where should I go?
Mary says she's not sure what to do, where to go. The employment office isn't safe, and she doesn't trust the local police.
Is safe. I don't know which one is which.
The reason Mary is whispering is because it's so dangerous to talk. These aren't phone calls. They're voice notes she's recorded into her phone.
I'm just hating the way I'm treated. I'm hating everything.
Mary cleans the 3-story bar and restaurant where she's working for up to 18 hours a day. She says she gets no breaks and is not allowed to leave until the venue closes at 2 a.m. The restaurant owner refuses to pay her. She sleeps in a building with 30 other people, with 2 bathrooms between them all. The restaurant doesn't provide meals, and Mary has no way of buying food herself. She's lost almost 70 pounds. CBC was not able to reach Mary's employer or her co-workers to corroborate her story. But anti-trafficking activists say it is consistent with other accounts from the region. The voice memos are a lifeline for Mary. She is sending them to a man she's never met, an anti-trafficking worker, thousands of kilometres away in Canada.
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Ward is Ward Reddick. He works with an international NGO called Rain Collective that is trying to disrupt the cycle of human trafficking.
Hi, Mary. Yes, I'd be happy to listen.
Ward records his own voice memos and sends them back so the two can have a kind of slow motion conversation about her ordeal.
I know it seems like it can't be worse, but it can be worse. And so I'm going to make some inquiries today.
Thank you so much. At least now I have a person to talk to. I have a person I can lean on.
Sadly, Mary's story is no surprise to Ward. For the past 6 years, the former investment advisor has heard many similar stories. Mary is one of hundreds of African women trapped in similar circumstances who are using audio recordings to chronicle their plights.
Hi Ward, Hi. How are you?
Hi Jasmine, come on in.
So nice to meet you.
Ward lives on a pretty tree-lined street in Vancouver. Sitting on a red leather armchair, clipboard and phone in hand.
Hi Mary, thank you for those messages.
He communicates via voice memos with victims trafficked from Africa to countries ranging from Iraq to India.
So from now on the plan is how to get you home, all right?
It all began for Ward after he moved to Uganda in 2008, where he ran a small business exporting jewellery. He returned to BC in 2015. The following year, a friend of his former domestic worker in Uganda contacted him from Oman. She told him she'd been trafficked. Like Mary, a shady recruiter had promised her a good-paying job, and now she was trapped.
I just discovered this the most horrific world and set of circumstances that I never run into personally.
Her traffickers were demanding a $2,500 ransom to let her go.
I sent a message direct to the people and said, okay, where do I send the money? And instantly, they just doubled the price.
The ransom was now $5,000. It took days of tense negotiations to get it back down. Ward was so overwhelmed that he didn't even think to call the local police. He raised the money through a GoFundMe campaign and paid the ransom. The woman was put on a flight home, and Ward learned an important lesson.
I became aware that that was basically just profiting the traffickers, and it was a naive blunder, but never again.
A few months later, he got another call from a woman whose niece had also been trafficked from Nigeria to Oman. She'd heard about Ward's earlier fundraising efforts.
And she was wondering, what do I do? How do I help her?
Ward wasn't working with Rain Collective yet. He was just a guy in Vancouver, keen to help. But with ransoms off the table, he had no idea how. Eventually, the woman contacted an NGO that helped her niece escape. But the requests kept coming, so Ward slowly figured out ways he could help from afar. One tactic, working with local activists to launch workplace complaints against traffickers. Sometimes just the threat of a government investigation was enough for them to send the women home. By the time the pandemic hit in 2020, human trafficking cases were dominating Ward's life.
Like to the point that it was using up most of the day. You know, prior to that, I was fitting it in around the rest of my life.
Mary wants to get back home. Ward encourages her not to run away, that life on Baghdad's streets would expose her to even more dangers. But when Mary discovers she isn't going to be paid, she refuses to leave her room. Her boss sends a man to collect her. When she tells him she's not going to work, he beats her.
They hit me up and I had to run.
Mary flees.
I ran for my life. I left everything there. So now I'm going to the office right now. But I don't know how the office people will react because I can't go back to where I sleep. I can't go to work.
Mary is going back to the employment office in Baghdad that placed her at the bar. But the employment office has become an impromptu home for struggling foreign workers. Mary is one of 40 foreign women living at the office. They're from Uganda, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Myanmar. No one is allowed to leave unless it's to work. She says their captors give the group a single bowl of rice to share. Two small spoonfuls a day for each of the women.
If they ask you for something and refuse, they will put handcuffs on you. At times they would lock you in a toilet for some good hours or days.
Mary is coerced into going out to clean a house. But when she arrives, she is too weak to even climb the stairs. The owners send her back. Meanwhile, Ward and Mary strategize over how to get her home. Mary calls the recruitment agent in Uganda who sent her to Iraq, but she says he tells her that he can't help. For the first 5 years, Ward worked mostly on his own, a volunteer, one-man anti-trafficking agency. His wife is Ugandan. She helped with translation and building trust with women. In July 2022, Ward made it official, taking his current position as a repatriation coordinator with Rain Collective. Now, Ward works on around a dozen cases each week. Ward estimates that he has helped more than 200 African women escape exploitation in the Middle East and Persian Gulf. Entebbe International Airport sits on a peninsula on the enormous Lake Victoria, just outside Kampala, Uganda. The departure lounge is outdoors and crowded, framed by kiosks selling SIM cards. A group of women dressed in green t-shirts and white headscarves sit anxiously on blue chairs. Maureen and Julie are waiting for a flight to the Persian Gulf.
We are going to Saudi Arabia. I'm going there to work. I'm going to look for money. So happy.
We are so proud on going to Saudi Arabia.
They're excited about the opportunity, saying there are no good-paying jobs for them in Uganda. They trust their recruitment agency to protect them while they're there. Kachoncho Robert is with them at the airport. He works for the agency. He claims complaints are usually more related to cultural differences than personal safety.
Have you had any complaints of women being beaten or abused, tortured?
Not being beaten, but you know, the cultures differ. Like you, if you're in Canada, your tone of accent of speaking is not like that of Americans. Now, the Arabs speak at a higher tone. Let's speak loudly. Yalla, yalla, yalla. Wow. It's that kind of thing. So our Ugandans are not used to being talked to, like being yelled at. So they become nervous.
But you must be aware that there are some levels of exploitation and abuse that's happening to women in these countries.
Yes.
Is it
Robert later admits a trafficker attempted to rape one of the women he sent to Saudi Arabia, but he insists that he trains women on the risks and he doesn't believe the potential dangers are a reason to stop sending them overseas. Nakatoni Sharifa works for another anti-trafficking group called Everfree International. She lives in an overcrowded area in Kampala. People in the streets play music and sell food from market stalls. A winding, unlit alleyway leads to Sharifa's place, which is set back from the main road in a maze-like urban settlement.
Yasmin, welcome to my house.
Thank you. That's a massive padlock you just opened.
Yeah.
A mosquito net hangs over the bed inside her one-room home. Suitcases crammed with clothes sit in a pile in a corner, like makeshift drawers. Sharifa works closely with Ward. They talk almost every day.
Hello.
Hey, bestie.
How are you doing?
So often, they call each other bestie.
Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. Just working on a few things from out in my backyard. What did you want to talk about first?
Sharifa came to this work from her own personal experience. At 19, she says her husband coerced her into working overseas. She ended up in Oman, and it was an experience on her very first day that cemented her path. Another worker sat next to her at the recruitment office. She was shaking with a fever and put her head on Sharifa's shoulder.
And I was waking her up so that I can go. And then he just pushed her and he said, "She's already dead. Don't disturb us with her. She's already dead." And she was already dead.
Sharifa spent 7 months in Oman cleaning homes for 20 hours a day. She says she was sometimes forced to work in leg chains and often beaten. She eventually made up a story about being an undercover agent with Interpol. That scared the traffickers enough to send her and 20 other women home. She's worked to help other trafficked women ever since.
I felt like I wish I could save the one who died in my hands. But if I can't, I can save more women.
Sharifa knows her efforts have made her a target.
Yeah, I think one day someone will just put a bullet in my head.
Someone will probably put a bullet in my head one day, she says.
I'm not scared because this is... I love doing this. If one day I die because of this job, then that is okay.
We need to take a quick break. Storylines will be right back.
From CBC Podcasts and the Fifth Estate, Brainwashed is a multi-part investigation into the CIA's experiments in mind control. From the Cold War and MKUltra to the so-called War on Terror, we learn about a psychiatrist who used his patients as human guinea pigs and what happens when the military and medicine collide. Listen to Brainwashed on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Recruitment agencies advertise openly in Uganda. The one used by Mary Kajumba, who was trapped in Iraq, is called Jobaz. Its Facebook ads feature a photo of a smiling woman wearing cleaning gloves, holding a mop and a bucket. Jobaz is a one-man operation. Francis Kereba's phone number is on the website.
Good morning, how are you?
At first, Francis is open to discussing work placements overseas.
Would you mind if I come and see you?
Until my questions get specific about Mary's ordeal.
It seems like I've really worried you.
Francis doesn't want to do a recorded interview. He claims it could get him killed because Jobaz doesn't have a business license. He says he's also worried about retribution from families of women he has placed overseas. Francis says he makes $3,000 to $5,000 US dollars per month, more than 20 times the average salary in Uganda. He says he advised Mary to leave Iraq after his relationship with the office in Baghdad fell apart. She says he offered no help in getting home.
Could you tell me about your previous job?
Well, I was the human resource officers.
Christian Mayanja worked as a recruiter for another company. Christian says domestic workers in Uganda earn less than 100 US dollars a month. They are promised four times that working abroad.
They will not tell you the negative consequences of what they are selling to you.
Christian says the recruitment company he worked for is legitimate. But he admits women are rarely warned about the risk of exploitation when working overseas.
They will always give you the positive side. They will give you the success stories. And they will never talk about the torture. That never happened.
According to the UN, the unemployment rate for women in Uganda is almost 12%. And almost 4 out of 10 women with a job still live under the international poverty line.
It will give you a good life, you will improve your well-being, you will pay fees for your kids. That is what is preached.
So when an agent knows that that person could be abused or tortured, how do they justify to themselves that they're still going to continue to do it?
For them, it is numbers. The more numbers, the more commission and the more payment. Very few of them will factor in the concept that, yes, there is a chance of them being tortured. That never happened at the point of recruitment.
Mary Kajumba certainly wasn't warned of the dangers. And it was only after she got deathly ill that she was finally able to leave Iraq.
They were afraid she was going to die. They would have looked at her sick and not seen a sick woman. They would have seen liability.
The recruitment office was willing to let her return home, but was demanding she pay her own way.
It's the knowledge that she's never going to be able to come up with the money that is a big part of how we move things to the day when they give up and send her home.
Rain Collective, the NGO that Ward works for, was able to cover the cost of the flight.
When I got out of the premises and I entered this taxi that took me to the airport, actually, I was having my ticket in my hands for all this time. And I could look at my ticket, see the vehicle moving, and I'm just imagining, is it me or anyone else?
When she boarded the plane, it still hadn't sunk in.
So when they started, the engine, I was like, it should hurry. Maybe they'll come and get me from here.
Sharifa was waiting for Mary at the airport in Uganda and relayed word of her arrival to Ward.
It's maybe usually when they get home that I really finally, you know, accept that it's actually happened. And then I get the biggest hit of dopamine. There's just nothing to compare it to. I go into my kitchen and I say, Alexa, play Center Field by Chuck Fogerty.
Center Field.
And then I dance alone in my kitchen until I'm exhausted.
Mary was hospitalized for a week when she got home with severe anemia. Now, she's settling back into life in Uganda.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Mary's three-room house is in Kabalagala, a bustling suburb of open-air markets off the main road into Kampala. Her long blonde and dark brown braids are swept up in a ponytail, and she wears fluffy slippers as she shows me around.
This is what I should call my living room. However, it is small, but don't mind me.
Her graduation photos sit on a glass shelf.
I have a diploma in art and design, and that is when I took these photos. That is way back in 2013.
Mary's daughter's eighth birthday is coming up. Before she went to Iraq, Mary took Ahidia to stay with a friend who lives in another city, 130 kilometers away.
Ahidia!
Wangi?
They talk on video calls.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Are you fine?
Yes.
I miss you.
I'm going to come.
You're going to come.
But Mary can't even afford the bus fare to bring her daughter home. Ahidia asks for robots and dolls for her birthday.
That is actually what took me there, because I wanted her to ask for something. And
that's actually what took her to Iraq. She wanted to be able to provide for her daughter, but she came back with nothing.
I can't provide anything for her. It's really hurting.
Mary is supporting herself by making jewellery and earns about $60 a month. It's barely enough to pay her rent. Mary dreams of starting her own business one day.
So my plan was maybe I should go there, get some capital, get some little money. If I can buy a plot of land for myself, if I can keep my daughter in school.
After I finished reporting, I wanted to help Mary reunite with her daughter. I drove her to visit Ahidia and bring her home with her. Mary's ordeal in Iraq forever bonded her with Ward, and helping her escape reminded Ward why he's drawn to this work.
There's no doubt that that the feeling of helping someone recover their freedom or to get control of their life again is extremely satisfying. I mean, it's like the feeling you get when you see your child be born. It's the feeling you get when you look at Michelangelo's David, like you, it's special. We don't even know what our freedom is until it's taken away. But then when it's taken away and they get it back, they fully understand it. And in those moments, you fully understand it too. And you realize that freedom is just an overwhelmingly precious gift.
I show you my phone. You know what I saved? on his number, Dad. In my whole life, I didn't see my dad. So I was like, let him be my dad, because he's been there for me in times where I needed to have a dad. That is what I called him even now.
After I finished reporting this documentary, Ward actually traveled to Kampala and had a chance to meet Mary in person. I wanted to know what that meeting was like. So I got both of them together on a call.
Hi.
Oh my gosh. Nice to see you. Hi, Mary.
When I spoke to them, Ward was in Vancouver and Mary was in Kampala.
It was really amazing that time when I saw him and I had to hug him for some good time.
It's great to see a person once they've returned home and to some extent they've resumed their identity and they've resumed their life.
I was also curious what it meant to Mary to have her daughter back living with her now.
It took like a month or two for her to go back to school. And since then, I've been living with her. Even up to now, as I talk, I have her here with me.
Does she want to say anything?
Yes.
How was it seeing your mama again?
It was very exciting.
That's all for Storylines for this week. Today's episode was reported by me, Jasmine Jiwa. It was produced by John Chipman and story edited by Julia Pargle and Liz Hoth. It was also supported by the Pulitzer Center. A version of this documentary originally aired on The Current. Storylines is produced by AC Rowe and Craig Dessen. The show is part of the CBC Audio Doc Unit. If you like the show and care about documentaries like this one, please consider leaving us a review. I'm Jasmine Jiwa. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.